This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to The Journey. I'm your host, Chris DeMix, and this is where I pick the brains of your favorite musicians about their musical paths, from the very beginning and throughout the years, up until the present. How they got from point A to point B, from their earliest musical memories, that very first song they remember hearing, to who influenced and inspired them. The moment they knew they wanted to be a performer, what led them to their instrument of choice, embarrassing first recordings, performances, and everything in between. When they fully realized this was a pure, unadulterated passion, way more than just a fleeting hobby or something they enjoyed in passing. We go deep and get the inside scoop of how, why, and when this all began. No two stories are the same, each unique to the individuals telling them, and everyone as fascinating as the next. So join me now as we embark on another journey. Well, hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Journey. Today we are joined by guitarist and vocalist for Bowling for Soup, podcaster, solo artist who has a brand new country album, husband, father, and the voice of Chuck E. Cheese, Mr. Jarrett Reddick. Jarrett, how are you, buddy?
Man, I'm doing great. It's good to see you, man. How's everything?
Everything is fantastic. It's really good. And by the time this comes out, we're going to have announced our tour together.
Yeah, I know. And it's about time. You know, it's been too long. You know, we were touring together the summer before the world shut down. So, my goodness.
I know. Can't wait to get back out there. Well, same. I want you to take the listeners all the way back.
Okay.
What was your first musical memory? What moved you?
You know, my parents were pretty musical people, not necessarily instrument or, you know, that kind of thing, in that there was always music going on, always music playing in our house, always music in the car. You know, we went to church a lot when I was a kid. So, you know, but Church of Christ. So it was like a lot of vocal music. So I just kind of always around it. And, you know, it's just always something I was pretty enamored by. But I remember when I decided to, like, actually get into it. I remember the exact day when I knew that it was going to be if not my whole life, like a big part of my life. And I was in math class, and we were doing speed tests for multiplication. And if you made 100 on it, on the speed test, you got free time. If you didn't, then you had to practice. Well, I got 100, of course. And got free time, and Greg Norman, this kid, had brought his Walkman to school, and I heard Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train for the first time.
Nice.
People today don't even understand what Ozzy was in 1982. Like, he was the Prince of Darkness. He was terrifying, you know? And I just heard this, and I was freaked out. And so I got Blizzard of Oz and Shout at the Devil. I got those albums on the same day. And forever, I wanted to be Tommy Lee from that point on.
What age was this, roughly?
So I was around 12, 13 years old. When this started, and up until then, you know, I liked music. I mean, but I was into whatever my brother listened to. So, you know, if he was listening to REO Speedwagon, I listened to that. You know, he was Urban Cowboy came out, so we listened to country for a while. You know, it was kind of that whole thing where, you know, John Cougar was all over the place, John Cougar Mellencamp, and, you know, Michael Jackson. You know, and at that point, you just sort of listened, and you listened to whatever girls listened to. You know, but that's the day that it changed, as far as, like, it wasn't just this background thing to me anymore. At this point, I just became obsessed with,
right,
you know, this, and not only just music, but this genre of music, just metal, and hair metal and all of that, from literally from the magazines to the videos to the albums, just literally obsessed. Sports didn't matter anymore. I mean, I'd always been into sports,
yeah,
whether it be watching them or playing them. All of a sudden, you know, that's all I wanted to do.
You just reminded me of something. Well, first of all, you know, my earliest memories were like playing, you know, holding a tennis racket, like a guitar in front of a mirror. I was young. You sound like you were a little bit more of a late bloomer. And that's really surprising to me with how musical you are.
Yeah.
I don't know. I figured it would have been earlier.
You know, we definitely did that whole thing. I mean, really, you know, less than the guitar thing. I mean, really, it's funny. If we're going that far back, it was that, you know, this is true, man. I was always into girls, man. I like from literally kindergarten on, like I was never embarrassed about it. Like it was, you know, like my kids all still, you know, my son is 16 and he's still like, shut up, dad. You know, like, but you know, third grade, I remember, you know, Kim Burris and Bobby Sue LaVorne and, me and Lance Morrell, first, drummer of Bowling for Soup, and Monica Humphreys would sing Grease songs during recess. And, you know, like I was Danny and Kim Burris was Sandy. And, you know, like we would do the Grease soundtrack while all the other dudes were out playing soccer, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I would sort of lip sync to those things and do all of that. But there really wasn't a desire at all to like do it. You know, it was just more like I knew that I liked music, but really it didn't just absolutely grab me by the ears until, you know, 12, like I said, 12, 13, and then borderline obsession.
It's funny. I was obsessed from a very early age, but it was around, I think, 12 years old. I was still playing Little League Baseball, 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And I remember that my moment too, where everything changed.
Yeah.
I remember pitching a game, and as I'm throwing the ball, I'm trying to think of the track listing for Quiet Riot's Mental Health in my head. And right. It was as if at that very moment, and I'm sure you could relate, I loved wrestling as a kid. I used to go to parents used to take me to the matches down in Fort Myers. I loved wrestling. I loved baseball. Yeah. I loved sports. Right. I played it. But it was if everything at that moment took a backseat to music. And so now you get this Ozzy record, you get this Shout of the Devil record. What from there? Did you want to buy a guitar?
So this same kid, Greg Norman, like he was, you know, his brother was about 4 years older than us. And he was a drummer, and Greg was real into Kiss. And so his room, you know, in the sixth grade was already like my room would be the year later in the start of junior high, whereas you couldn't even see the paint on the walls. It was so covered in magazines and posters and just clippings of rock stars, Kiss and all of that. He was real into Ozzy and Kiss, but his brother played the drums and had this drum set in his room. And it was this little bitty room. It was basically all a bed and a drum set and this huge Rush poster. And I was just like, oh man, I want to be like your brother. I want to get a drum set. So that same day, we went to this, we used to go to this pawn shop and look around, and they had this pair of Promark drumsticks. So I bought these drumsticks and I went home and I asked my dad for a drum set for Christmas, and he just laughed. You know, he's like, yeah, all right. Well, you know, of course, wounded, I limped back to my room, and I guess I begged enough and I got it. You know, I got a drum set for Christmas, and my parents were actually in AA from the time I was in third grade, and they went to AA with this guy, with this dude, like this old dude that like had played drums, you know, for bands when he was, you know, an adult and whatever. I don't know that it matters that he was an adult. Anyway, he had played in bands and he had played in bands and could play the drums. And so he started coming over to my house on a certain night a week after an AA meeting. So we would start at like 9:30 at night, you know, and my brother would be in the other room just cussing. And, you know, he's 5 years older than me and just thought that this was a complete waste of time, and taught me how to play drums. But this dude knew how to do it so that, you know, it would stick with me forever. He didn't just teach me to play the drums. He actually made me learn all the rudiments and taught me snare drum and all of this stuff first. Like, he had the insight to actually teach me all of this stuff. And it's so, Chris, it's so wax on, wax off, man. It's so like paint the, sand the floor and all of that, where, cause you're learning all that and all you want to do is play the drums and that's it. And then it's like a year after you've like started playing drums and you think, why did I have to learn all that stuff? And all of a sudden you need to crash this certain cymbal with your left hand. And so you do a paradiddle to that floor tom and bam on that cymbal. And you're just like, oh, well, it all makes sense now, you know? And so, you know, I mean, it's crazy how, you know, all of that stuff. And then you start to go, okay, well now a ratamacue would be, it would work this way. And so applying all of that to the drum set, I was really, really lucky that he had set me up that way. And plus then it got me into honors band, you know, all through school. And, you know, I played in orchestra. I played the timpanis and snare drum and the marching band and all of that. And
so can you still get around on a drum kit these days?
I can still do okay. Yeah, I can.
I've never heard you play. And that's so crazy. Most of the musicians, my friends that I've talked to over the years, they all wanted to be a drummer, at least at first. They wanted to bang that noise. I never did because I just instinctually knew that I would suck. I get behind a drum set, I'm the worst drummer in the world. Okay.
You know, it's a big lead singer thing, actually. You know, like, it's like Stacey Jones from American Hi-Fi is a drummer, and, you know, Steven Tyler was a drummer, and Don Henley is a drummer. And, you know, it's crazy how many singers, you know, played drums first, or at least that became one of their instruments that they played. And then it just, maybe it's just this cry for attention. You know, maybe it's like, I'm going to be the loudest, but wait a minute. Now that guy's got a microphone. That's a lot of power. You know, like I want to be, want that.
And he's standing in front.
Exactly. That's a lot of that. That guy's getting a lot of attention, you know, and that could definitely be it. But, you know, there's
Tommy Lee's roller coaster wasn't invented yet to fly out in the front of the crowd.
No, but I did see that just a couple of years after, you know, starting, because I wanted to be Tommy Lee, you know, like you know, you look back on those first two albums and the videos or whatever, there's no cooler band that's ever existed than Motley Crue, and I would fight that to the death. And
they were larger than life.
Larger than life. They're the original gangster rap. Like, they're like, you know what I mean? Like, they were already in hot tubs with chicks and money and stuff, like, before even rappers were doing that. It was like they were just it's crazy how huge they made themselves. And all by design. And we all bought it. Like, I bought it, and I bought everything. I bought it, you know?
At what point now, you said you were in marching band, you were playing the timpanis.
Yeah.
At what point did you say either, hey, I want to be a singer or I want to be a guitar player or both?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not sure. I'm sure it was probably like this in your town, too. But, you know, being in bands, it was pretty incestuous. Like, this guy would go be in that band and this guy would go be in that band, and we would all, you know, bands would break up and you'd borrow this guy and all this. So I was kind of in one of the two or three bands in town that was really, really good. And I was pretty lucky. I was pretty good at the drums, actually. And, you know, back then playing metal, like I could do all the double bass stuff and you know, I could play like Anthrax songs, and not everybody could do that. And so I was always in a band with dudes that were older than me, like 18-year-old kids. And so, you know, I kind of always had got to be in the bands that were really, really good. So fast forward to, we kind of have this band that's supposed to be, you know, the bomb diggity dog in town. And, you know, our singer moves away and we don't have a singer. And we're actually getting heavier at the time anyway. So we're kind of starting to do more like Slayer, Testament, Obituary, you know, that kind of stuff. And our bass player was actually a really good drummer. And we knew a dude that could play bass because he had been in our band before playing bass. And I was just like, I don't know, I'll just sing until we find somebody, you know, and then we'll just figure it out. And that's kind of it. I was like 17 at the time, and really, I never really got back behind the drums in a serious way ever. So really, my drum career was about 5 years, and which is crazy because I'm not bad. Like, I can sit behind the. I mean, I could get on stage and play a song with you guys, and you wouldn't know that I have that I, you know, haven't really played in a long time.
Oh yeah, well, So at this point, like, were you guys, it's hard to play places when you're not 18. Okay.
Right.
You can't get into most bars. Were you playing gigs, doing talent shows? Where were you playing?
We were pretty, I was pretty lucky because everybody in my band was older than me. And so we were getting to play in clubs, but we weren't allowed to ever go into the bar. So like we could play, but we'd literally be outside the back door and it'd be like, come set up, and you'd go and you'd set up your stuff and then you'd have to leave out the back door that you came in. And so, yeah, you know, talent shows, couple of backyards. I mean, quite frankly, really back then, it was just all about rehearsal and being as good as you could possibly be. I mean, you know, that we were so good, like the, you know, and the guitars were so intricate, and we did all that stuff. They did all that stuff.
What was the band called?
Terminal Seasons.
Love it.
Yeah.
Do you have a demo of Terminal Seasons you could share with the listeners?
I could probably dig something up that that, you know, I'm sure that I probably can.
The problem with finding demos when you're our age, Jared, is that most of them are on cassette.
Yeah, well, also, we didn't ever record because nobody would write songs. This is getting into the next question you're going to ask me, which is going to be why I picked up the guitar. And that's because these dudes didn't want to write songs. Well, I'm in this metal band, Terminal Seasons. We're playing and finally doing shows and all this. And then I went to college, and I went to college in the same town, so I was still in this band, but I met this kid, and his name was Shrub Roundtree. And we hit it off at we had to go to this thing called Spirit Days to get, instead of an orientation, you did this thing called Spirit Days. And if you did that, then you didn't have to take this certain class. It's kind of dumb, but anyway, it worked. Basically, it was to familiarize you with the campus and get you some friends and all of this. So you're sort of set up to go to college, and then you're away from mom and dad and all that.
Okay.
And so I meet this kid, and he liked a couple of the same bands that I did, and Nirvana was breaking at the time, and Soundgarden and all of that stuff was starting to happen. But this kid let me hear the Descendants, and then he let me hear the Ramones, and then he let me hear Green Day, like early Green Day. I mean, we're talking like the 7 inches that he had like put on cassette, you know? And I just like, I remember hearing the Descendants for the first time and going, wait a minute, so this is exactly what we're doing. It's just, he's singing about girls and farts, like stuff that he knows about. Like, I don't, you know, because back then, if you were in a metal band back then, like you had to get like a medical dictionary to write lyrics, you know, like you couldn't just go like, you know, I was walking down the street and I saw this girl, you know, like back then it was just like creating a life to destroy, you know, it's like, it just,
yeah,
that's, it's just so different. And then I heard these lyrics, and then, you know, you hear Green Day and this band called the Parasites that I really loved, and Screeching Weasel, and, you know, I was just, all of a sudden I'm like, okay, so these guys are playing fast. The guitars are loud and heavy, but I can actually play this stuff if I want to on pretty much any instrument. So I just got a guitar, and I was just like, I'm just going to start writing songs, you know? And that pretty much meant at the time that I was not in Terminal Seasons anymore, because this was it. So it was almost like my life had changed twice. That first time I heard Ozzy, and then when I heard the Descendants, it was literally like, it was a hard left, dude. Like it was literally like, oh, I don't do metal anymore.
It's crazy. I have the kind of the same story. I didn't pick up the guitar till I was 18. I was a late bloomer.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the same thing with you.
Yeah,
but
this is early 20s. Yeah.
I wasn't 18 in 1984 trying to learn Eddie Van Halen and Yngwie Malmsteen licks.
Exactly.
I was now on a playing field with guys that were basically playing three chords. And I went, aha. That was my aha moment.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more.
DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities. From easily paying collaborators with splits, to securing your music with DistroLock, DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
So if you go back to like the stuff that we listened to in the 80s, you mentioned Quiet Riot. I don't think people, a guy explained this to me one day, and I was like, oh my God, that's so true. People don't understand that guys like Dee Snider and Kevin Dubrow, like dudes that sound like that, are the best singers in metal, and the hard, it's so hard to sing that stuff because they make it sound so easy. But go try and do Come On Feel the Noise at karaoke and then come at me. Go. So you think my singing's out of time? It makes me money. I don't know why. I don't know why anymore. Oh no. So come on, feel the noise. Girls, pop your voice. That is a very hard song to sing. And I, you know what, man, I have a pretty good range, right? Like, that's hard. And so you couldn't sing that stuff, you know? And then you had the, you know, but we were listening to like TNT. And
oh, and for those that don't know, Tony Harnell from TNT is up there with the greats.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, he can sing like Steve Perry, which a lot of those guys painted themselves into a corner. That was the other thing about punk rock that I loved.
Exactly.
I went, wait a second, I can sing in my range?
Exactly.
Because, man, you get up to being our age now, you know, middle-aged guys, you can't sing. None of those guys, they're all down-tuning now. They can't, you can't expect to sing that high anymore.
There's a couple of them that still can, but it's not many. And you know, but so that goes in hand with it. I couldn't play those guitar parts. I could not play those drum parts. I could play the drum parts. Sorry, I couldn't play those bass parts. You know, I didn't even know how to play bass. But you know, I couldn't. I could sing those songs, kinda. You know, like it'd be like the thing where it'd be like, okay, the new Queensryche album is out. Which songs can you sing, Jarrett? We'll work those up. You know, kind of thing. Like, well, I can do "Don't Trust the Needle." You know, the Needle Lies or whatever. But I can't do Queen of the Reich, you know, because who can?
You know, no one can hit the high note at the top of that song.
Yeah, you know, so, it's crazy.
Around this time now, you hear Descendants, and this is like the second switch that goes off for you. The first one being in the 80s with the Motley Records, and now the next switch goes.
Yeah.
Are you starting to write songs for Bowling for Soup? And how close was this to 1994? Because I believe that was the first Bowling for Soup independent record, correct?
Yeah. So this is early 90s. This is like 90 to 92 when all of this is going down. And in 92, I actually started a band with that dude that let me hear the Descendants, and Lance, the original drummer for Bowling for Soup. who I had known since I was 4 years old. We had been best buddies, you know, on and off since then. And that pretty much, that band was called Cool Fork, and with a little C and an exclamation point at the end, which starts the whole Bowling for Soup with the exclamation points thing.
As bands did in the 90s.
Yeah. And so Cool Fork, and that laid the foundation of everything. And so that band was instrumental in my songwriting in that I really wasn't a lyricist yet, but Shrub would write words and then I would just put music to it. The cool thing was, is that we listened to what the Descendants became was a band called All, and arrangements could be just wacky. Like there didn't have to be any song structure at all. Like it was just verses didn't sound the same. Like it just the way that those dudes wrote, it was a ride, you know? And so I was like, well, I can do this. And so I would, you know, when I started writing songs, I didn't have any rules. So it very early in my songwriting just taught me that you don't have to follow this structure. You don't have to do this. It doesn't have to go intro, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, out. You know, it doesn't have to do that, which I think I'm lucky to have learned that. Because the only other way you learn that is if you heard the Beatles and then you started writing songs instantly. If you listen to everybody who is influenced by the Beatles, then you have all the structures already there. And you're going, okay, it goes verse, chorus.
Yeah.
So yeah, 2 years of that band and then some of those songs then did become Bowling for Soup songs. And so that would have been like the beginning of that. 92 would have been the beginning of, and again, literally had just started playing the guitar. Like, even in the early days of Bowling for Soup, like, I really didn't know what I was doing. It was very much self-taught. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know all the notes or what they were. I just memorized patterns. So I would just write it, you know, and it'd be the pattern, and I knew. I was real good at that thing where you could drop the... if you're doing a power chord on the A and the D string, you could drop that your ring finger down to the G string, and all of a sudden you're doing an octave thing.
Yeah.
So that's why Bowling for Soup is so octavey, because I learned that thing. That's all Cool Fork was just that thing back and forth.
Gotcha.
And so Bowling for Soup happens, and I'm just like, well, I could do this octave thing. We'll just do this octave thing all the time, you know? And that became a big part of our songs.
So by this point, you kind of know what your lot in life's going to be. You're going to be a musician, whether you are going to make money at it, whether you're living on mom's couch, you're going to be a musician. That's how I felt. I money was not an object. It was, where's the next house party? Where's the next case of beer? Yeah. When can we record again? This is all happening so fast. At what moment in Bowling for Soup did you have another light bulb go off? You're like, wait a second. I think we could really do this as a career. Was it a show? Was it a reaction to a single you put out? What moment was that?
Well, I will tell you, I know that this is a short show, so I'm going to do this quick. But while all this stuff and music is going on, life is also happening. I had actually started a business with my girlfriend's dad when I was 17. And we opened up a toy store, and by the time I was 22 or whatever, we had a full-time toy store that was open year-round, and then we'd open up like 8 other stores at Christmas time in other cities, and we'd bring them all back. It's kind of like
that's awesome,
that Halloween store that pops up every year. We would do that with toys every year. So that business went under when Category Killers came in, Toys R Us and all of that, and Nintendo became more popular than bikes. We couldn't compete. And so I had to do something else. All this time, I'm going to college, by the way, starting in 90. And so around 94, toy store closes. I graduate from college, and I started this dude's brother moved to town, and we started a home building business because this guy was a home builder. So I learned we built 3 houses from the ground up, and that business went belly up because we built a spec home. And about 2 months before we went on the market, they put a coin-operated car wash about 2 blocks away, and that was the end of that deal.
Oh.
It just profited by. Yeah. So, final straw, I'm coming out of that, and I do a summer of building above-ground swimming pools. And so I've always been super entrepreneurial, and so I build above-ground swimming pools for this whole summer. I employ all my friends and all these businesses and all this stuff. End of that summer, we're in 96, and we play a show in Abilene, Texas, Bowling for Soup. So we're 2 years in, about 2.5 years in, and up, right at 2 years, actually. We play the show in Abilene, Texas. We open up for this band called The Hunger. And
oh,
we had
I remember them.
Yeah, yeah. We had been play, they had that song, Vanishing Cream. We're there, and we had managed to get a couple of songs on this radio station there. And we play the show. It's sold out, and we had played Abilene a few times, but just the reaction of this crowd and them singing our words and just all of this stuff. And here I am with two college degrees and three companies that had either gone under or that just we weren't doing it anymore. I was tired of responsibility. I'd never really been able to go out and just be, and I was just like, it that night I got off stage, I threw up in a trash can, we went upstairs to this makeshift dressing room that they had set up in this conference room, and I pulled the guys aside and I said, I think we can do this. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. I think if you guys trust me and you just do everything that I say and we all put this first, I think we can do it. Like, we can do this. And everybody's like, yeah, okay. And that was the commitment. And the commitment was band comes first. No more birthday parties. No more anniversaries. No more funerals. Band was first. This is what we do. And that seems harsh. But to the listener, if you've got four guys and you add a tech and you have, you know, everybody goes to two birthday parties that are on weekends a year, and then you go to four weddings and you do this or whatever. That's a lot of nights that you can't play. So yeah, those are gone. Rule number two, if we're asked to go to an after party, we go. Doesn't matter if you're sick or you have to work in the morning. If we are asked to go to an after party, you go. Why? Because if we had 20 people at that show and we go to a party, the next time we come, we're going to have 40 people at that show. And that just goes on and on and on from there was to the commitment to the band. And, you know, it did work. It took a long time. You know, yeah. I mean, we didn't sign our deal until 99 and didn't have a hit until 2003. So it was in a van from 94 to 2003.
Well, I was going to say, I think, again, everyone I've talked to has that moment. And that's awesome. That was your moment. And then you had the talk. I remember having the talk. I think we can do this, guys.
Yeah.
You get out. You get your deal in 99. Early 2000s, you have massive hits with 1985, Girl All the Bad Guys Want, and you just, year after year after year, you're still out there doing it.
Yeah.
What, if you could look back, and it could be even before Bowling for Soup, what is your proudest moment?
Well, the proudest moment is pretty easy for me, and that is in 2003, on January the 7th, my ex-wife was in labor. They were about to put the epidural in her back. And the phone in the room rings, and the nurse answers it. She goes, Mr. Reddick? And I go, yeah. I mean, just hang up. This guy says he needs to talk to you. You know, I'm like, okay. So I pick up the phone. I'm like, this better be good. I'm in the middle of some serious shit. And voice on the other line is our manager at the time. And he says, hey, man, I'm sorry to bug you, but I just needed to tell you, like, you just got nominated for a Grammy. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. And I hang up, right? And so my ex-wife is crying, like, who would call right now or whatever? I'm like, apparently we got nominated for a Grammy. And she's like, what? And the nurse is like, oh, my God, this is crazy. Are you going to go? What are you going to wear or whatever? And I'm like, guys, we got an epidural needle to put in here. Everybody, let's focus. You know?
Regroup.
My daughter Emma was born a few hours later, and I went down. You know, we had had a really long night, and I went down to have something to eat in the cafeteria, and I opened up for some reason, so weird, the Dallas Morning News. I never read the paper, and this is before smartphones, and the Dallas Morning News is sitting there, and it was like Grammy nominees, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'll just open this up, and my first child had just been born, and my band got nominated for a fucking Grammy on the same day, you know, and
so
it was like
awesome.
There in the paper. And I'm just like, so it's other, you know, there's so many of those highs. You know, we've done so much. We've seen the world so many. We've played for the troops in places that people can't, won't ever be able to go. You know, people don't even know exist, actually, a couple of them.
We've met our heroes, man.
We've met our fucking, dude, yeah, I text with Dee Snider and Sebastian Bach. You know what I mean? Like, I, you know, it's, you know, and again, like, yeah, that's the thing, right? Now, my favorite band in the world, the Descendants, like, I have two of their phone numbers. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you've toured with them, for Christ's sake, you know? Like,
I know. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Stefan,
it's
like, Stefan plays on my new country record, by the way.
I know. It's so cool.
It's crazy.
Why don't you come back home to me?
And so you're right. Like, when your heroes become your peers, you're just like, it's fucking weird. You know what the weirdest thing part about that is? That time that I saw you guys play with the Descendants, by the way, not that long ago, four or so years ago here in Dallas.
Yeah.
And then, so Stefan comes out afterwards, and then here's the, I'm talking to Stefan, who I've known for years, and he just goes, hey, is it cool if my kids come take a picture with you or whatever? And I'm like, do you realize how fucking crazy that is to ask me that? You
know, I know.
It's just so nuts.
I know. I still get nervous around those guys. It's weird. They're my friends, but I see them and I'm like, oh, there's Bill. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, in closing, I just want to say congratulations on all your continued success.
Thank you
for being my friend.
Oh, man.
You are one of the busiest people in rock and roll. I totally respect you, totally support you, and I can't wait to get back out there and rock with you.
Man, me too. And you know, I feel the same way about you. You know, I mean, you're one of the first people that ever took up for us in just the weirdest sort of way that day in Dallas. I'll never forget that. And then to be able to tour together and to call you friend. And I respect the shit out of you. Congratulations on, you know, the podcast and then the satellites from the podcast. I know it's going really well. And
appreciate it.
It's funny. I feel like people who work really hard attract other people that work hard, and we all feed off of one another. And so I think that's why you and I get along so well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, everybody, for sitting with us, and we'll see you on the next journey.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.